You're listening to the 21st episode of the Roman and the Kill Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akhil Krishnan.
And I'm Arman Rana. We're broadcasting this episode live on Saturday, the 2nd of November at 5:01 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Han Kamino-speaking Musqueam people.
So, Arman, how have things been with you since our last show?
Yes, things have been good. It's the BC election was a bit nerve-wracking. We still actually officially do not know, you know, they're doing the recount business. But, yeah, pretty much the NDP got a slim majority in the end.
Are you suggesting the lieutenant governor might have jumped the gun?
I think she jumped at the appropriate time, the process, has to play. So, like, he doesn't feel comfortable. I think, you know, if he had a bigger lead, one seat wouldn't have made a huge difference. Like, he could have just started, you know, opened up the legislature. But because he's got a lead of one, like, he's got a majority of one seat, he kind of has to wait for that recount, because he'll look like a fool if he starts swearing in cabinet ministers and then one person gets overturned by a recount, right? So, I think it was an interesting experience, for sure.
Yeah, and, I understand you spent a lot of time with the election stuff, a lot more than I did, and usually I'm the one who's an apparatchik.
Yeah.
How does it feel?
Yeah, the times change. But I'm still not an apparatchik. I haven't signed up as a loyal.
No, it doesn't matter what you are officially on paper. It's your actions that matter, Roman.
Yeah, I was actually doing a secret undercover work for John Rustad the whole time. Speaking of elections, how are you feeling about the, you know, there's a small one happening in a couple of days. I know nobody's talking about it. I know. It's not in the news, but how are you feeling about it?
But generally with these local elections, these local North American elections, they don't really pay much attention to it because, you know, when it's federal parliament, legislative assembly, or Vancouver City Council.
It's on the news everywhere. Everybody's talking about it. But nobody talks about U.S.
here,
elections.
From here to Timbuktu to Perth to everywhere, right? Yeah. People are talking about it. But yeah, there's this tiny one going on south of the border.
Yeah. And just a few hundred million people voting in it, but
which, you know, you and I are ethnically Indian, I'm from India, so you know,
nothing.
What's a few hundred million people?
Yeah, nothing.
Tell me when you get into the serious numbers.
You can't even win UP with those numbers.
Exactly.
UP, for our listeners, is the largest province in India. It's got a population of 240 million people.
Yeah. So UP stands for Uttar Pradesh.
Yeah.
What's on today's show?
Before, we have a wonderful guest in the studio to help us break down the very important U.S. elections coming up. But before we get to that, I just wanted to give people an idea on Tuesday how to watch the show, like, you know, when results are going to be coming in. So it seems like North Carolina and Georgia are going to be the states out of the swing states, you know, the seven swing states, North Carolina, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada. Out of those, you know, seven big swing states, North Carolina and Georgia are the ones that are going to be coming in first. Mm. So if you tune in at around, you know, 4 or 5 p.m. Pacific time, you'll start to see, you know, results starting to trickle in for those states. And that might give early indicators. If it looks like she's winning either of those states,
the election isn't legitimate.
The chances of her losing are very slim.
For sure.
The most important state is Pennsylvania, based on all the modeling and just because it's the biggest swing state.
And with its 19 electoral votes.
And it's very close. But that one could take longer for the results to come in. Last time it took 4 days. This time it could be a bit shorter because they've sped things up a bit. But it still could be a bit longer. I just wanted to give that pro tip because people are always like very confused. They watch elections come in. They see a bunch of like very red, like Indiana come in early. And they're like, oh, no, the election's over. He won into Indiana by 30 points. Kamala Harris is doomed. But, you know, it doesn't work like that.
For sure.
And the other thing I wanted to bring up was Iowa.
The Salsa poll.
The Salsa poll, which everybody was like, it's one of the, considered one of the most accurate polls of any state in the States. And everybody on Twitter was like concerned about like, okay, was it going to be like, because Trump won the state by 9 points last time. It's not a swing state. But if Trump is ahead in that poll by, let's say, 5 points, that could be good for Harris. If he's ahead by like 11 points, that's good for Trump. And anything between is kind of like a toss-up. The Salsa poll actually had Harris ahead by 3 points, which was a big, you know, very unexpected.
Just for our listeners, the Salsa poll was conducted by Salsa & Co., whose founder is J. Ann Salsa. And Armand literally jumped out of his seat when the tweet dropped.
That the poll and I wasn't the only one. If you look at the Poly Market, like the betting odds, which have Trump slightly favored, it went from like, you know, 58 to 55 in the matter of minutes after it dropped. So yeah, and it still seems to be, you know, since 4 o'clock, that information still seems to be percolating on Poly Market. But anyway, yeah. So in studio, let me talk a bit about our guest. We have Aiden, rhymes with Biden, a Berkeley exchange student here at UBC, who's going to help break down this upcoming election. So, you know, it's thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on here. It's
welcome
an
to
honor
the show.
To be here.
So, Aiden, where are you from?
I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area of California. I was born there to immigrant parents from Iran. I've lived there all my life until now. And now I live in Vancouver. I'm an exchange student at UBC.
What are you studying?
I'm studying microbial biology at UC Berkeley. So a comparable major here would be MBIM, microbiology and immunology.
And what do you hope to do?
I'm on the pre-med track. It's been my dream since I was 8 years old to be a doctor.
Why do you want to be a doctor?
Okay, you know, Iranian, it's the stereotype. You can be any kind of doctor you want. But no, I made that decision by myself, and my family did not pressure me into it. They support me, of course, but...
You can be honest with that. They're not listening to me.
I know, they're probably going to be listening. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. But no, seriously, though, when I was 8 years old, I actually got to shadow my aunt at her clinic in Iran. She's a physical medicine rehabilitation specialist, and I saw the life-changing work that she did with her patients, including her ability to reach out to patients who suffered from health inequities and inequities in the healthcare system, and she was able to reach these people and touch their lives, and it combines my interest in science and evidence and looking at the facts and being able to problem solve and work with people, so that's why I've been so enthusiastic about pursuing the pre-med track.
And so what do your parents, are your parents also doctors, or what? What did they do?
That's an interesting question, actually. My dad is technically a doctor. He has a PhD. However, both of my parents are educated in the humanities, and they are humanities professors.
Okay.
So my mom focuses on teaching ancient civilizations and focusing on how yesterday shapes today. And my dad is actually an AI expert from the non-tech side of things. So his focus is on AI and its impact on humanity and society from the perspective of someone who's not necessarily making the AI, but people who have to use AI in everyday life and deal with AI and its impact on society.
So what's your, you said you were studying, so you're an undergrad?
Yes, I'm in my fourth year of undergrad.
You're in your fourth year of undergrad. The reason I ask that is this going to be the first time you're voting in an election?
It's actually my third time voting in an election, but it's
in a presidential election.
Oh, yes. It's going to be my first time voting in a presidential election. Last time we had one, I was 16. I was too young to vote, but I was very enthusiastic.
I just want to understand a bit more about, you know, your background before we get into politics is, what was your parents' immigration story? Like you said, you come from Iran. What was their motivator to come here?
That's a good question, actually. So my dad is one of the immigrants who came before the revolution in Iran, and he was motivated by opportunity. And, you know, like everyone in Iran and the rest of the world at the time, they saw American pop culture in videos and in music, and they heard about America from everyone who had been there. And my dad just loved America. You know, he loved what it stood for, the opportunities that were there, the wonderful education that he could get going to an American university. And he had relatives in his family who had gone to America and been successful. So he wanted to follow in their footsteps and go chase the American dream. So he came to America as a student in high school, actually, right before the Iranian Revolution. And my mom, however, she stayed in Iran. My whole family from my mom's side is still in Iran. And she went through the revolution. She went through the 8 years of war with Iraq. And she went to university in Iran. She studied film. And she immigrated to the United States when she married my dad. But she always had this desire to explore. She always loved to explore the world, see what's out there. And she knew that she wanted to come to North America. She wanted to use skills immigration to come to either Canada or the United States. And fun story, actually, when she first met my dad, the first question was not, do you want to go out with me? The first question was, can I work for you? Can you get me a work visa?
Interesting.
Something I wanted to just ask you, you know, you've been in Canada for a while now. What do you like most about being in Vancouver? What do you like doing outside of, say, your political involvement outside of school? What do you like doing?
Vancouver, obviously, you know, it's known for its nature. So I love having parks like Pacific Spirit literally in my backyard. I can see Pacific Spirit Park from my window. But also just being able to go outside and having that fresh air, seeing the mountains, the scenery, having easy access to things like beaches, parks, hiking, lakes. I love that. You know, California as well, we have great nature, but here it's like a different climate. So it's nice being able to see that difference. But also, I love Vancouver's fusion between being a vibrant city with amazing urban life, great infrastructure, public transportation, amazing food, good nightlife, all that, but also having the calmness that most big cities lack. So you compare Vancouver, say, to Toronto, Seattle, New York City, even San Francisco, and Vancouver just seems a lot more chill, seems more laid back, a little more relaxing. You step outside and you don't have that intense hustle and bustle, but at the same time, it's not sleepy. It's not a small town, and you still have all the amazing amenities of a big city. And it's beautiful. I love the urban design here, and I love how Vancouver is not scared to push the narrative and change things, you know? They're not scared of breaking the status quo, and urban design in Vancouver definitely shows that, and I love that.
I feel like the laid-back feeling that Vancouver has is traditionally been attributed by most Canadians to the purported use of high use of cannabis in the city, even if that's not really the case.
Yes, I've definitely heard that.
So what how did you decide to come as an exchange student to Vancouver, to Canada? You know, you're studying in the US. I mean, you want to go on exchange. Was it the school? Was it you just wanting to experience you know, Canada specifically, like all of the things you said about Vancouver? Why not go somewhere else? Why not travel halfway across the world to, I don't know, Southeast Asia, something completely different?
Yeah, I get this question all the time. In fact, last night, a U.S. border guard asked me the same question. He's like, why Vancouver? He just gave me a blank stare for a moment when I told him I was an exchange student. He's like,
You can moonlight as a U.S. border guard.
So he was like,
My tone was much nicer than the border guard from the sound of it.
So you're doing a semester abroad? I said, yes. Why Vancouver? So I've just always been fascinated by Canada. And ever since I was a kid, you know, I grew up watching a lot of TV shows that were Canadian. Some of them I knew they were Canadian. Some of them only recently I found out they were Canadian. And in 2009, I remember coming to Vancouver for the second time, but first time that I actually remembered. And I had some distant relatives here, still do. We came to visit them for Persian New Year. And when we came here, it was interesting to me how this country may seem to be similar to the United States on the surface. You know, landing here, the power outlets are the same, the cars look the same, you know, you can plug stuff in, everything just kind of looks the same. You know, you've got the same style of suburban housing and everything. But then the little details really caught me. And I was really fascinated by these little details. You know, the currency's the dollar, but it's not the same dollar. Your phone isn't, you just can't turn on your phone and use it like it's back home. There are different cell phone networks. And what else? Oh, yeah, the houses are different. You know, growing up in San Francisco houses are really small. So going to Coquitlam and seeing my relative's house in Westwood Plateau, I was just blown away. I'm like, wait, do these people just live in these massive houses? And then also seeing, you know, Vancouver's signature, like, suburban high-rise condos, going there and seeing how you have to use a fob to operate the elevator, which was a totally new concept to me. All that really fascinated me. And at first, I found Canada a little bit intimidating. But then later on, I visited again in 2016, and I just really started to like it. And in 2020, my fascination got piqued by an urban planning video I saw about Vancouverism and how Vancouver has essentially pioneered this idea of cities should be for living in North America. And they built...
Shocking radical
concept. I know. They started with the West End. They're like, instead of building commie blocks, we're going to build these point towers. And we're going to build parks around them. We're going to have a beach where you can look to the mountains and you can actually see the mountains. You're not going to see a concrete jungle because we're going to separate the buildings to make sure you can see the mountains. And then they continued this approach. They built Yale Town, Coal Harbor, Metrotown, Brentwood, and they just kept going out into the suburbs. And they connected all of this with public transit. And that really fascinated me. And I just started following more local news from Vancouver and seeing how Canada really handled the pandemic better. And I got really jealous. I thought, huh, you know what? I wish I lived in Canada. And I told myself, well, I can't. I can live in Canada while I'm young. So I looked into whether I could come here as an exchange student because I could not afford to come here as an international student. I just don't have that kind of money. But I realized that I could come here as an exchange student, and I took advantage of it during my second to last semester of undergrad, and I really love it.
That's fantastic. And before we ask anything else, you said you found Canada intimidating. Why?
I guess as a kid,
like, traditionally, you know, regardless of the veracity of this claim, Canadians are super polite, welcoming. Beavers look really cute. Maple syrup.
Oh yeah, Canada.
Outside of hockey,
it's amazing. You know?
You know,
yeah, the Canadians are nice. I even had friendly interactions with the geese, which is unheard of.
I don't believe that.
You don't believe it, but it's true.
Intimidated by the geese. So what were you intimidated about?
I think I was intimidated by just the difference, you know, because I was 5 years old at the time. My whole world was just my neighborhood in San Francisco and Iran. And, you know, Iran was a place I was familiar with because I went and visited often. And I knew it was a totally different world, but it was a world I was familiar with. But just coming into somewhere that was unfamiliar, and it really threw me off at how I just couldn't predict whether something was going to be the same or different. Like, it was very much like a box of chocolates, but it was a box of chocolates where you can't flip it over and actually read what each chocolate is. Like, it was really like that metaphor. You just reach in there and you don't know if something's going to be exactly the same or it's going to be something totally new. Like, I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, in Canada, they didn't have, at the time when I visited, wheeled carts for garbage weren't common. Instead, you had the very traditional garbage cans that I only saw in cartoons. I'm like, wait, this is weird.
The aluminium, like,
yeah, like the ones with the lid on it, you seal it, it's like, whoa, like, okay, that is weird. Like, I can't just take my water bottle and throw it in the garbage. Like, I've got to take a look and see, okay, this is garbage. Where's the recycling? Wait, so it's not a wheeled bin. You've got to throw it into this, like, blue box, but it's too small. Like, all these things really tripped me up. So I guess that's what I mean by intimidating. It wasn't necessarily scary. Just to me, it was a whole new world. And I wasn't ready to deal with, like, the differences that were kind of minor. You know, like, I didn't know if something was going to be exactly the same or just totally new.
I think what your description of Vancouver, this very positive description of Vancouver,
especially the urban life assessment.
Yeah, it's just it's refreshing to hear, I guess. But it's kind of just the dominant kind of, at least political rhetoric about Vancouver as a fail city, as a hell. I don't know what he called it. Pierre Poilievre of a hellhole or something.
Yeah, something.
John Russ said 1 in 2 people, youths, are leaving. And, so, yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Unlike Alberta, we are a rodent-infested mess, unfortunately, you know. But, you know, something you said about it being a little bit different and you not knowing what was, like, in the box, right? That's a little bit like how you two met, Isn't that right, Imran? How did you meet Biden?
Yeah, I was canvassing for a political party I shall not mention, and I met Biden, and he was very much into politics. And speaking of which, I guess is have you been, you know, politically active your whole life? You know, what activated your political involvement?
It started in the fall of 2015. I was in grade 6, and I knew that a presidential election was coming up, and I knew that the president can only serve 2 terms in the U.S. So I went to my dad, and I just asked him, so who's running? And he said, you know, there's this guy by the name of Bernie Sanders. Like, those are the magic words, and it just started it all. And that was what really sparked my interest in trying to figure out, like, what the societal problems are in our society and what politicians are proposing to fix it. And what I quickly realized was most politicians in America don't care. They don't really care when it comes to actually solving issues. They will pander to the masses and they will throw crumbs. And this is especially, I've seen this with the Democrats. Like, Obama was a perfect example of this. He had a supermajority. We had a Democrat House, Democrat Senate, Democrat president, and all of the big promises, change, forward, everything that he said during his campaign just didn't really come to fruition during his first 2 years in office when we had all that blue. So the House, Senate, and president. So that really made me realize that, wait, most politicians don't care, but there is this one politician who does care. But the system is rigged. You know, corporations are allowed to just pour money into backing things, opposing things, and they can sway the masses, and people don't know. People will quickly fall for fear, uncertainty, and doubt, the FUD campaigns. Like, I remember that year, there was a ballot measure in California to allow the state to negotiate prescription drug prices. And the pharmaceutical industry just, like, pumped money into it, claiming that innovation would suffer. They scared people, and people fell for it. So that made me realize
that... So that ballot measure lost?
Yes, at the time it lost. And now there's another measure that might bring that around the second
time. At the federal
time.
Level, they're already doing it now, right?
Biden has finally started it for Medicare. But that only really applies to people who are 65 and older or with a disability. Okay. So for people who have to get private insurance, that still doesn't apply. They don't benefit from it yet.
I see.
Yeah. But Bernie Sanders' campaign really gave me hope that we can push back against a system that's stacked against us. And I really liked his anti-establishment vibe and the fact that he was willing to fight for the people. But what annoyed me was how people saw Donald Trump as also being anti-establishment. Whereas when you look at Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump's the billionaire. Bernie Sanders is the guy from Vermont who flies economy class despite being in Senate. So Bernie is the anti-establishment. Donald Trump is just a different establishment.
Different anti-establishment.
I guess you could say he's from an establishment, exactly. But he's just not from the political establishment.
Right, which is, I think a lot of voters in 2016 kind of were allured by that, this idea that, yes, he's a billionaire.
He's an outsider.
Right, he's a successful businessman, which was the pitch that was being made to the American people at the time, right? But not a political, not from the political class, so to speak. So that it's interesting, right? Because you said Bernie was an anti-establishment, but a lot of people saw Trump as being anti-establishment too, in a very different way.
Yeah, and I think the processes for nominating candidates in the Republican Party are more democratic than in the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party has what are called superdelegates, who essentially are not tied by a vote, and instead they're just party elites who can choose to vote whatever candidate they want for the nomination. So I think that's partly why Bernie lost the Democratic nomination. But because Trump won the Republican nomination by a more democratic process, that's why a lot of people voted for him, even if they were traditionally on the left, because they just wanted to vote for a disruptor. They want a change. And I will admit personally, I was actually a little happy that night that Hillary lost, because I didn't know how bad Trump actually could be. I just thought he was incompetent. I thought, you know, we were going to have 4 years of a clown show, and then the Democratic Party will learn their lesson not to screw with the will of voters and to push politicians who are just outdated. They're done. They cannot just keep running and trying to build their career. The Democratic Party needed to listen to the voices of the voters, and unfortunately, they didn't. And I think they still aren't.
So you mentioned, right, that the, that politicians run on fear, uncertainty, and
doubt,
right? But if you look at the things that say Donald Trump said, he was saying a lot of the stuff that that ended up happening, whether or not he wanted it to happen, right? He basically he goes into a rally and he says whatever he thinks will get the crowd going, and he workshops himself in real time, which is really interesting to see from a political candidate, which you don't usually see. How does the thinking evolve from going from, you know, evaluating, saying that like Bernie is the best candidate to being, say, almost a little happy in a shock to the system kind of way that Donald Trump won?
I guess for me it was mostly just
I don't think it's unique to any small subset of people, right?
Yeah, my mom actually told me about one of her students who voted Bernie in the Democratic primary and then voted Trump in the general in 2016. I think a lot of it had to do with just my sheer anger towards Hillary and how she got her cronies to steal the nomination from Bernie and pump all of this fear, uncertainty, and doubt about this so-called socialist candidate into the minds of the masses. Like, I know somebody who was in my grade six class whose parents were physicians, and they voted against Bernie in the primary because they were convinced that if Bernie won, their salaries would be cut in half, which is just not true. There's zero evidence to suggest that, but they fell for it anyways. And a lot of Americans saw Hillary. They saw the fact that they had the chance to elect the first female president, and they ran with that. And they didn't care that policy-wise, the better option was Bernie Sanders, at least in my opinion. They just wanted to focus on identity politics. And they didn't realize that Hillary Clinton was responsible for all the wars that started under Obama. She is, I would argue, the most violent Democrat who has ever held a political position. Because when she was Secretary of State, a lot of Middle Eastern wars erupted under Obama. Because if we look at Obama, all the wars that erupted in the Middle East were under his first term. But then when he dumped Clinton and he went with John Kerry for Secretary of State, everything changed. You know, we saw diplomacy in the Middle East instead of wars, instead of sanctions, instead of crazy rhetoric. And it was working until Trump came in. So that's why I really did not like Hillary.
So coming, you know, Hillary, the 2016, this is not a 2016 election. In the 2024 election, you're supporting Kamala Harris, right?
Yes, I already dropped my ballot about a month ago. I drove over the border, dropped it at Blaine USPS, and I voted Harris without any sort of hesitation, without thinking that I'm picking the lesser of two evils. For me, what really mattered was getting rid of Trump. And even though at first I did not like Harris, especially in 2020 when she was running, after reading more about her track record as a prosecutor and the things she's done in her career, the more I realized that she's a better politician than Joe Biden and most of the Democrats, including Hillary Clinton.
So why? What specific? Is there something specific, like specifically that she's done or accomplished? Say one or top, aside of getting rid of Trump, because it seems like you don't like Trump. But aside from that, is there any specific policy item that she's accomplished or she's promised to implement that you would like to highlight, like top one or two?
So for me, when it comes to her track record, there's two things. There's reducing violent crime and not going like full prison monger. So she did not reduce violent crime just by locking people up on the smallest offenses. That's a common line that is repeated about her. And I even believed that until I actually like read up on her history. And also, she's honest. When she makes a promise, she follows through with it. For example, she promised to never implement the death penalty. She never sought the death penalty when she was a prosecutor, both at the city level and at the state level. And she followed through with that even when the police union, one of the most powerful organizations in America, are the police unions. They pressured her to pursue the death penalty when a police officer was murdered. But she said, I am opposed to the death penalty. When I say I am not going to pursue the death penalty, I am not pursuing the death penalty, even if you try to leverage your position as the police union to get me to pursue it. She did not. So that, for me, is a green flag. And also, when people talk about how she convicted so many people on marijuana offenses, she actually did not jail a single person for possession of marijuana. Only 64 people were locked up during her tenure as San Francisco prosecutor for marijuana, and those offenses were all extra charges on people who had been convicted of violent crimes.
I see. So, that's kind of backward look, but forward looking in terms of her plans in going into the future. Is there anything there that you would highlight her plans for America, or is it more just like her track record and you don't like Trump?
I think her tax plan is definitely a good step forward, especially considering that we're reeling from the disaster that was Trump's TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which actually now is starting to expire. So middle-income Americans are seeing their taxes go up, which they're falsely attributing to the current administration, whereas in reality, the law came from Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has made it clear that he loves giving tax cuts and corporate welfare to his wealthy buddies. But Kamala Harris's tax plan is going to raise money to pay for things that America desperately needs, but she's actually going to cut taxes on the majority of Americans who work for a living. So I agree with that policy. And I think a continuation of the existing Democratic platform, such as Medicare negotiating drug prices, capping drug prices overall for Americans, and codifying reproductive rights in the laws of the United States. Because unfortunately, our Constitution never mentions reproductive rights. And ever since the Supreme Court said no government can be prohibited from restricting reproductive rights, I think it's really important to pass a law to fully codify reproductive rights so that no government, federal nor lower state level, can touch our reproductive rights.
So for you, you'd say it's the... If you had to say, like, what are your top three issues in this election? Like, setting aside the fact that Donald Trump, you believe, is an existential threat to your democracy.
Yes.
Which, obviously, is a big, big, big topic of concern. But what would you say is the top three issues going into this election?
Good question. I'd say freedom. So that's kind of overarching. One of the components.
No, hold
of
on now. You're stealing the rights.
Yes, I am.
Rights talking points.
I am. And I am proud
that's
of that.
That's a slogan of Kamala Harris. All her campaign merch is freedom, freedom.
Yeah, because I am proud of actually standing for freedom. And that's part of what I like about Canada, which I believe Canada actually has more freedom. It's a more free country here than the United States. But I digress. Freedom for me. You know, the first priority is freedom of speech. The Republican Party has made it clear that they want to lock up anyone who disagrees with them. They want to legalize people driving over protesters, like hitting protesters with their car when they disagree with the protester. And they want to lock up people, take their jobs, kick them out of university for standing up against the status quo, the government, and actions that the government is taking. And then, like I mentioned before, reproductive rights. The right to choose whether a pregnant person wants an abortion or not is freedom. And it's clear that Donald Trump is not only against the right to choose, he wants to ban abortion federally. And the thing that the Republicans fail to mention is that when Roe v. Wade was struck down, that didn't just return it to the states. There is no law that says reproductive rights shall be governed by the states. It just says, you know, governments in the United States are free to ban abortion, and that includes the federal government. And because the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution of the United States, if the federal government bans something, all lower governments, including states, have to follow through. So that's why I say freedom is the number one priority. So freedom of speech, reproductive rights, and the freedom to assemble, all of that. Second priority would be healthy communities. So that includes healthcare. So expanding access to healthcare, because Donald Trump has made it clear he wants to roll back the Affordable Care Act. Even though I do not like the Affordable Care Act, I think it's a poor implementation of our one chance towards getting universal health coverage. It still was a game changer. People cannot be denied healthcare for pre-existing conditions. Certain services must be covered by any insurance. There are limits on out-of-pocket expenses. And most importantly, Medicaid was expanded. So the uninsured rate dropped significantly when the Affordable Care Act came into force. And it's clear that Donald Trump wants to get rid of that. But for Kamala Harris, she wants to continue the Biden administration's policy of negotiating drug prices, which is unprecedented. The pharmaceutical industry has a chokehold on America on both sides of the political spectrum. So this, for me, is a big deal. And third of all, safety. I agree with the Democrats' policies on gun laws and gun control. And I think that if we have a true Democrat-controlled government in House, Senate, and presidency. Because the last time that happened with Biden, we had two senators I call dinos, Democrats in name only. They weren't really Democrats, and they didn't want to implement a lot of these policies. But if we get Democrats...
And you're talking about... and who are the dinos?
Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. So if
Of whom have vacated their seats.
Yes, thankfully. I'm very happy about that. So if we can get Democrats...
Joe Manchin surprise, likely to be replaced with a Republican, right?
Yeah.
Oh, pardon?
Joe Manchin is likely to be replaced by a Republican, which makes it a little
That's
bit more
difficult.
That's
unfortunate, yes. But at least people will finally know. So we won't be able to say like, oh, Democrats had control and they did nothing. It's like, no, that person wasn't a Democrat. Because him being replaced by a Republican just shows the true colors of the electorate. But anyways, gun control is also important. Safety in schools. The school that I went to got a shooting threat when I was in grade 11. And this was like a very safe school, small school, safe community. And we still got a shooting threat. So that's really important to me.
So, you know, talking about the top three issues that are important to you and like what you want, kind of value in this election, what do you see as being what have you I know you canvassed in Canada. It's a little bit of foreign interference right there. But what have you done in terms of, you know, canvassing or phone banking or anything for the election?
So a lot of it has been peer-to-peer interactions. You know, I'm from a solid blue state. It's pretty difficult to really make a difference in a solid blue state. But a lot of it does include reaching out to friends who may be going to school in swing states. Because in the United States, if you're going to school somewhere, you could either keep your voter registration in your home state or switch over and re-register to vote in your state that you're going to school in. So talking to friends going to University of Arizona, for example, and talking about the importance of voting in a swing state, strategic voting, but also really reaching out to everyone, because I have friends across the country, and bringing up some issues that might complicate things. So one example is a discussion I had with a classmate regarding the Democrats' policy on Israel. Because I'm opposed to Israel's policies in the Middle East and Israel's genocide of Palestinians. That I'm not talking about just the killings that have been happening in the past year. I'm talking about history of genocide. Decades of genocide and erasure of Palestinians that has been supported by Democrats and Republicans alike. And this is an issue. Like, this is the one thing I will call Harris out on, is that she has not made it clear that she stands with Palestine. She has only paid lip service to Israel. And while it is important to point out that Netanyahu does not want Harris to be president, he wants Trump. And there's clearly a reason behind that. I disagree with the Democrats' policy on Israel. And some voters that I have spoken to, including my friend here, said that they're not going to vote at all, or they are going to cast a protest vote for a third party candidate. But we have to take into account what's at stake here. Because if Donald Trump wins, it's going to wreak havoc on our country. It's going to result in Israel getting more empowered to take land from Lebanon, to wipe out Gaza once and for all and turn it into a beachfront retirement community for wealthy Americans. And Israel is going to start a war with Iran. That's my biggest fear.
So it's interesting you say that, because something that that we discussed a little bit earlier, especially about the 2016 election, was a lot of people thinking somehow that it was a done deal, said, you know, I'm just going to vote for this other candidate or vote for a third party candidate as a protest vote. Do you think that people have learned from that? Do you think a lot of people who are going to be voting for third party candidates on this specific issue?
That's an interesting question, because I'm going to say they have learned from it, but learning does not necessarily mean that you might change your action. Learning just means that they know about the spoiler effect. Some people are voting for Jill Stein deliberately because they learned this fact. So Jill Stein herself has said she is not going to become president. She knows that. She is just focused on ruining the Democrats, and she's focused on taking away the state of Michigan from Harris, which inadvertently means handing it to Donald Trump. And her focus is just to halt the Democratic Party's platform. But it's clear that the Green Party doesn't really care about their platform, because I don't see Green Party candidates running down ballot. I don't see the Green Party ever investing the same type of efforts that grassroots candidates like Ilhan Omar have invested to be elected to Congress. I don't see that. I don't see them running candidates in local races for state legislatures. I just don't see them. They're absent, but they show up every 4 years to run on a very idealistic platform for president without really addressing how they're going to implement that platform. And their goal is just to take votes from Democrats.
Do we need to take an ad break? Just want to check with a quick time check.
If you're just tuning in, I think we do need to take an ad break. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Rahman and Nikhil show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're just going to take a quick break, and after that, we will continue our conversation with Aiden, rhyming with Biden.
Are you someone in recovery? Someone struggling with addiction or disordered eating? Or are you simply curious to explore your relationship to alcohol, drugs, and other types of addictive behaviors? The UBC Student Recovery Community is a safe space to connect with others. The SRC provides many types of support, such as drop-in hours, recovery meetings, one-on-one support, and even has a dedicated recovery lounge. The SRC supports all pathways of recovery, from harm reduction to abstinence and everything in between. You can learn more at recovery_UBC on Instagram. And you can also contact the community at src.recovery@ubc.ca. Remember, you're not alone.
What a lovely Vancouver summer night. I can't wait to sit by myself at the beach and look at my phone. Huh? What's that?
Man, what are you doing? Get over here and come jam.
Wow, what a lovely assortment of musicians. What are you guys doing?
This is East Studio. We come together and build connections over music. No musical experience needed. Just come socialize and build your confidence playing music if that's your thing.
Wow, this is so awesome. Now I have a real-life connections with Vancouver's international community of musicians and creatives. Thank you, E-Studio. E-Studio is an international jam group where we celebrate music from all around the world and play together. Follow us on Instagram at estudio.cafe. estudio.cafe.
This is a journey into sound. I shouldn't be nugget. Gotta have house
music. Hi, this is DJ Wah, inviting you to join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. here on 101.9 CITR for Techno Progressivo. You in my head now,
my life. This is the house that funk built. This is the house that funk built.
Techno Progressivo is the only radio show in Vancouver where you'll hear the best mix of new tech house, techno, and progressive house.
A body bang. A...
So join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. for Techno Progressivo.
House music. House music.
What a lovely Vancouver summer night. I can't wait to sit by myself at the beach and look at my phone. Huh? What's that?
Man, what are you doing? Get over here and come jam.
Wow, what a lovely assortment of musicians. What are you guys doing?
This is East Studio. We come together and build connections over music. No musical experience needed. Just come socialize and build your confidence playing music if that's your thing.
Wow, this is so awesome. Now I have a real-life connections with Vancouver's international community of musicians and creatives. Thank you, E-Studio. E-Studio is an international jam group where we celebrate music from all around the world and play together. Follow us on Instagram at estudio.cafe. estudio.cafe.
And we're back. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the Rahman and Nikhil show on CITR 101.9 FM, where we're talking to Aiden, rhyming with Biden, about the U.S. election. Aiden is an exchange student from the United States, from San Francisco in California, and we're just going to pick up our conversation with Aiden.
Yeah, I think one question I had for you, is there anything that, you know, Trump could change in his policies and his approach to politics that would make you switch your vote?
Of course. You know, in politics, I don't care about the person running. I care about what they claim and what they align with and who they surround themselves with. So if all of a sudden Trump cut ties with Elon Musk, cut ties with RFK Jr., Joe Rogan, and he dumped J.D. Vance and all of the Republicans who are, you know, part of this evangelical cult, and he just completely did a 180, and he changed his stance on immigration, supported reforming our immigration system to include a skills immigration pathway, to focus on creating a pathway for people who want a better life for themselves and can contribute to the United States so that they can actually come to the United States legally. And if he took a stand against Israel's crimes, that would make me consider voting for him. Granted, you know, I've already voted, so that part is over. But in the future, if he were to run for any position and he were to change his policy in that way, I would consider.
As an 82-year-old man or something, 100-year-old man.
But, I mean, yeah, he's know, old.
Old dogs, new tricks.
Yeah,
but if all of a sudden he does a 180 and he surrounds himself with people who prove that he's not lying, sure, I'd consider voting.
So let's talk a bit more about immigration. You yourself are a son of immigrants. What's your perspective on, you know, immigration policy, how it's evolved from both parties? Recently, you know, the Democrats have now become, you know, a lot more tough on the border as well, rhetorically at least. And, you know, Trump is talking about people eating dogs and cats.
What is your
perception on the immigration conversation right now in America?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of immigrants in America are torn on this issue. On one hand, you've got some immigrants who are adopting this really hardline rhetoric and they're going with the whole "I suffered, so you must suffer," talking about their struggles immigrating and saying, well, you know, I came here legally. I did everything right. If you don't do everything the way I did it, get the hell out of America. But, you know, my family, we have a lot more compassion. We know that people go through a lot of struggles, especially the refugees showing up on our southern border. They are fleeing horrible gang violence. You know, in grade 8, I read a book called Enrique's Journey, which is fiction, but it's based off of research that the author did, interviews with immigrants and refugees coming from Central America. And it's clear that these people are not coming here for crime. They're not coming here to eat our pets. They're not coming here to harm America. They are coming to America.
It's Haitian asylum seekers that are allegedly eating pets.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is also, like, the Haitians, they have the same struggle. You know, their route to the United States is different, obviously, because Haiti is an island. But they have the same motivations for leaving their country. Because if you follow the news, you know Haiti is going through a horrendous crisis. Gangs have taken over the country. And we see similar situations, obviously not as extreme. But in Honduras, we see that in El Salvador. Luckily, El Salvador has changed a lot recently. But up until the past few years, El Salvador also had the same gang problem. Guatemala, Nicaragua, in much of Central America, and in parts of Mexico, we have a lot of gang activity. And these gangs are oftentimes more powerful than the government. So that's a lot of motivation for people to leave to save themselves. And they just need a better life. And the U.S. is the first country that they get to that offers that better life. I think it is extremely cruel to put these people and their kids in concentration camps, to brand them as criminals, as rapists, and to just kick them out and say, come back legally. Because guess what? The way the U.S. immigration system works, there is no line. There is no line you can get into to immigrate. And even for the people who have a family connection to immigrate legally, that line is decades long. When my mom became a U.S. citizen in 2007, she started working on paperwork to bring her sisters over to the United States. Because in the United States, the immigration system is kind of broken in a sense where I call it closed to new entrants. Where if you just have skills and you want to come based off of your own merit and your skills, you're pretty much never coming. But if you have family, all of a sudden, you are guaranteed a green card. You just gotta wait a long time. So in 2010, when my mom filed the paperwork, she was told it's a 13-year wait. Now it's almost 2025, and my aunts have not heard back from USCIS regarding their application. We just know that they're still processing. And that's actually because of the Trump administration. They deliberately slowed down the processing of applications for legal immigration simply because they're anti-immigration, period. They claim that they have no problem with legal immigration, but when it comes to increasing legal immigration and creating a pathway so that people who want to come can come legally, they're against that. They do not want to increase legal immigration, and they want to be very inhumane towards immigrants who have come here illegally.
So, in fact, you know, it's interesting you said this about immigration, but it's not. It wasn't one of your top three concerns in this election. And it's interesting to me the difference that different people have, say someone in a border state, as the Republicans repeatedly say, you know, like border state Americans are very concerned. What do you think is the concern of someone, you know, who's not in a border state?
Well, I'm in that weird interstitial state where I'm kind of both in a border state and not, because California is a border state, but my city is 8 hours from the border. So I'm in that area where obviously, you know, immigration to me, I'd say, is the fourth issue. But since you asked for three, I only had to give my top three, but it's still very important to me. But I think border state or not border state, the so-called crisis at the border is overhyped. Because I have been to San Diego twice in the past 2 years. I've driven over the border. I've been on both sides of that border with Mexico. I've gone up to the fence at the border. I've put my hand on the fence. I've put my hand through the fence even. So I have been very involved with the border. I've gone to the border. I've seen it. And I don't see hordes of people just coming, climbing over, and just trying to get into the United States. It's not an invasion the way Republicans are framing it.
The technical term is a caravan.
Yes, the caravan. I have not seen any caravans. And it's not like when you drive into Tijuana, you just see entire caravans camped out by the banks of the Tijuana River waiting to get over. The way the Republicans frame it is an over-exaggeration. Obviously, there are a lot of people showing up, but we've always had people showing up at the southern border. You know, that's the gateway to opportunity. And I think it's wrong for any immigrant in the United States to gatekeep the United States. I just think it's wrong for someone to say, well, you know, I came here legally. I have zero compassion for these people, especially the immigrants who come through the easiest pathways. You know, the ones with job offers at tech companies where the company does all the heavy lifting, gets them one of those rare H-1B work visas. They come in. And for them to say that about these people fleeing literal imminent death, I think is so insensitive. And I hate the hypocrisy from immigrants, including in my own Iranian immigrant community, where they just have no sympathy for immigrants. Whereas in my family, my parents suffered through immigration hell. And because of that, they don't want people to suffer. They say, you know, we struggled through this. We don't want others to have to go through what we went through. So I think that's the difference between my family and maybe some other immigrants who are voting Trump.
What would you say to someone who is compassionate about, you know, immigrants going through, or, you know, those horrible experiences, you know, south of the border? At the same time, they believe that from an economic perspective, immigration drives down wages in the United States.
All I have to say is that the research shows that that's not true. Immigration does not drive down wages. Immigration fills shortages in sectors where, you know, regardless of the wages, it just fills gaps in sectors where we have a shortage of workers. So in the United States, we have a labor shortage across the board. You know, in the skilled industries, we have a shortage of skilled workers. And some of that is compensated by bringing in skilled workers from Mexico and Canada under the USMCA agreement, because that's a different class of visa and that's not subject to immigration caps. But for unskilled labor, there exists zero pathway to fill that with labor that's not US citizen labor. So people saying that immigration drives down wages, if you just look at the research from professors of economics, you'll find that immigrants showing up don't drive down wages in the United States. And I'm not generalizing this to the rest of the world, but if we look at the United States, that's just not true. And the rhetoric that Trump is pushing, saying that immigrants are taking black jobs, is not only wrong, but it's so racist. He's saying that black Americans only work unskilled jobs, and that if the immigrants were gone, all of a sudden, black Americans would be earning more in unskilled jobs. And he's neglecting the fact that black Americans are Americans. We're all Americans. You know, our ethnicities and our backgrounds don't separate us. And to break us up along racial lines and to say that one group only works unskilled, one group works skilled, is just entirely wrong.
Which is also funny because Donald Trump took a black person's job.
Yes.
I did want to ask you we're almost out of time, but something that we did ask our previous guest, and something that I think as an American I want you to weigh in on. You know, January 6th, I remember where I was. I'm not American. I'm Canadian. And I remember where I was when I first saw the first messages coming about that, the pictures. I still remember what it felt like to see what a country I think we regard as a robust democracy, the oldest modern democracy in the world. So do you remember where you were?
Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday. It was, you know, it was a sunny, crisp, cool California winter day. We were in lockdown. COVID was surging. And I was in my AP statistics class. We were on online school. I was in the Google Meet. And I don't remember the statistics topic we were talking about, even though that was my favorite class in grade 12. But all of a sudden, I get an Instagram DM from my friend. He says, "Aiden, are you seeing this? They've stormed the Capitol." Like, what the hell? So I just ignore it. I think, oh, okay, yeah, there's protests, whatever. You know, they're going to be mad. They lost. But I just put my phone away, focus on the stats. And then as soon as class ends, I go on the news. I go on Reddit. I'm like, oh, my goodness, what is going on? I just remember seeing the headlines. And by the time I found out about it, it was mostly over. But just seeing those headlines and seeing the images and just hearing everything pouring in through the rest of the day regarding what happened – I was stunned. I had predicted that some MAGA people would get really riled up to the point of becoming violent because, you know, they're the ones with the guns. They're the ones with the short temper, and they're the ones who are most likely to draw a gun when they lose. And they're the ones saying that they didn't lose and it was stolen. But just to actually see it materialize was a whole other thing. And I was just stunned. For the rest of the day, I just couldn't believe that this was my country.
I think a lot of Americans probably felt that way.
We'll find out how many did in a couple
and
of days.
And if they learned their lesson, so to speak.
I think, yeah, one thing I just want to re-highlight is there's no evidence that anybody's eating cats and dogs. Because I made a joke earlier.
Yes,
about
thank you
cats
for bringing that up.
That was a joke.
It's a quote attributable to a candidate.
Yeah. President Trump claimed that, but they, you know, multiple people have looked into this. There's zero evidence that I think there's one lady who claims some immigrants are eating her cat or something, and she found it in the basement and made this huge apology about it. So I just wanted to, you know, clarify that.
I'm glad you preempted PolitiFact because they were going to be all over you.
Yeah, just don't spread fake news. There's enough fake news in this world. Thanks so much, Aiden rhymes with Biden, for coming on our show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm glad you invited me here. Happy to be here.
Yeah, a few other things to wrap up. You can find us on the Arman Kull on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. Helps a lot.
No, please.
The music for the show is composed by the incomparable Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed.
We do have an awesome set of... we have some awesome shows lined up with a great set of guests. Do listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out. Have a good night.